Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. This morning, the court has only one matter on its oral submission docket, and that is West Orange Coast Consolidated Independent School District and others versus Felipe Alanox in his capacity as Commissioner of Education and others. This case is from Travis County and was appealed through the Third Court of Appeals in Austin. The court has allotted 45 minutes for each side to present oral argument. We will take a break in between the presentation of the petitioner's opening and the respondent's argument. And then the petitioner may reserve a portion of this time, of their total of 45 minutes, for rebuttal argument by advising the marshal of the court. These arguments are being recorded by our clerk, and you may purchase a tape of the argument for a nominal fee. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners.
May it please the court, if needed for help, to present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner, you have 15 minutes for the mic.
May it please the court. 8 years ago, this court forecast the very circumstances that bring us here today. In Edgewood 4, this court said, and I quote, "If the cost of providing for a general diffusion of knowledge continues to rise, as it surely will, the minimum rate at which a district must tax will also rise." Indeed, between 1995, the year that Edgewood 4 was decided, and today, the predicted march of tax rates to the statutory cap of $1.50 has occurred. This is illustrated, Your Honors, by the handout that I hope the court has received that we filed this morning. And at tabs 2, 3, and 4, we have provided the court with bar charts that show the inexorable march of the tax rates up to the statutory cap. The bar chart behind tab 2 gives you a snapshot of what the tax situation looked like at the time of Edgewood 4. That's on the left. On the right, you'll see the absolute reverse. That's a snapshot of how the tax rates look today. Behind
are these this year's tax rates in our record, or do we have to take judicial notice?
You have to take judicial notice. Those have been provided. There is no dispute, however, Your Honor, about the accuracy of the numbers. They come from the state. So there's no dispute about the accuracy. Behind tab 3, you see a further breakdown which shows what has happened over a period of time, which is that the number of districts has skyrocketed to $1.50. It has skyrocketed between $1.45 and $1.50, and same with $1.40 up. And if I may draw your attention to the chart at tab 4, because this will give us some conclusions with which to work. And what this shows is that almost 40% of the school districts in this state, which represents almost half of the school children in the state of Texas, are now taxing at the statutory cap. And that almost 60% of our districts are between $1.45 and $1.50, and that represents 75% of our school children. Because of this, what is happening right now, if you're picking up the paper and looking at it, is that hundreds of districts all throughout the state are implementing drastic cuts of both programming and staff. Now, I quickly want to make this point. This is not a rich versus poor issue. This is an issue that confronts all districts at all levels throughout the state. And that is why, and I will draw your attention to this, the Edgewood interveners agreed with us in the trial court. I would refer your honors to the record, the clerk's record, at page 184, and I'll quote from the Edgewood pleading. "Edgewood interveners would agree that there is insufficient funding to meet all of the needs for Texas students at the $1.50 M&O funding level. And indeed, that's why the Edgewood interveners also intervened on our side of the docket." In other words, they did not think a tax suit should go forward, but when it came to whether the $1.50 provides sufficient funding, they cross-intervened on our side. And that's at page 186 of the clerk's record.
Ms. Cortell, can we be precise when you say insufficient funding? Are you saying that $1.50 is the absolute minimum for the constitutional standard of general diffusion of knowledge?
We do believe that under Edgewood 4, we are at the cap when we say $1.50 is insufficient for funding, yes. But
insufficient to provide the general, the constitutional standard. That's what I just
want
to make clear.
Yes, yes. But what I would like to develop in my argument is a couple of things about Edgewood 4. And again, going back to the, if you will, the tab 2 and how we looked at that.
Well, let me just follow up on Justice Jefferson's question. If we were to find that general diffusion of knowledge is synonymous with basic accreditation, can you make your case below?
I absolutely think we can, Your Honor, and that's for several reasons. One is that general diffusion of knowledge, if you tie it to accreditation and you look at what's happened now with the accreditation standards, it is not at all what was in front of the court in 1995 with Edgewood 4. You will know, I'm sure, that the accountability system that we've had in the past is the TOS system, and we had a very low threshold. We are now in the midst of a great sea change, and not only at the state level, but also at the federal.
Well, let me make sure I understand. Are you saying you'd have to change the accreditation standard and then get there, or under the accreditation standard as it is now, would you be able to make your case?
The latter. I think what we've seen is just a sea change in what accreditation means, actually. And this actually had started at the time we were in the trial court, and it's just gotten more and more clear. If I may, I'll quote from the superintendent of the Austin Independent School District. And what they're talking about, Your Honors, is the difference, and I hate to use all these acronyms, but you know, this is a case with a lot of acronyms, so I'll go with it. The TOS test is what we've had all these years. It's only tested historically reading, math, and writing, I believe, just those three areas. Now we have a whole new curriculum. It's called TEKS, T-E-K-S, Texas Essential Knowledge, so forth. And then it's going to be tested by something called TOCS, Texas Association of Knowledge. Knowledge and Skills is what it's called. And also, let me mention, at the federal level, we now have something called No Child Left Behind. No Child Left Behind. All of this is raising the bar incredibly, and to prepare our teachers and to prepare our students to be able to meet these new standards, it's going to be a lot more expensive.
And that's is it important to your case on the merits that you prove how much more expensive? Dollar-wise.
I believe ultimately I think the court should allow us to go back down, although I think there's a pathway to rendition as well. But if we're allowed to go back down, I do think we would have to show what it takes to meet general diffusion of knowledge and an adequate education, whatever standards this court wants to put us under, and to cost that out to show that we must tax to achieve that, and I think we can absolutely do that.
And would your approach be different from the state's approach in determining the $4,100 number that was used in the trial?
Of course, one of the great problems we've had, Your Honor, is not being ever able to get behind whatever numbers they threw out there. But we think that those numbers do not tell the story. They didn't tell them then, and they don't tell them now. And I want to go ahead and make one other point. When we talk about what does this equation look like under the constitutional claim, are we limited at looking at accreditation, I want to refer the court, and I don't think this is in the briefing, and I apologize for that. This comes from preparation for argument, and you always learn something as you get ready. But I'd like to refer the court to section 42.002B of the Education Code. And this is a very interesting provision because it defines what the foundation school program is supposed to consist of. It talks about the two tiers, okay, and then it says the two tiers have to provide for two things, not just accreditation, but also enrichment. And let me quote for you. It must provide for A, sufficient financing for all school districts to provide a basic program of education that is rated academically acceptable or higher under section 39.072 and meets other applicable legal standards, which is going to be the TEKS, the TOCS, the No Child Left Behind, etc. And B, very important, and B, substantially equal access to funds to provide an enriched program. So I believe that if the $1.50 is both of these, then I don't think there will be any problem at all for petitioners or anyone in this state to show that you at least have to be at $1.50 to meet these objectives. And let me point out.
The majority appears to believe that it can pinpoint what rate was necessary for a general diffusion of knowledge by deference to legislative standards. I mean, they use this $4,100-some-odd number, and $1.31 for property poor districts and $1.22 for property rich districts. Do you believe the court was just in error in getting to that degree of specificity, or that the law has changed since that time, or that needs have changed?
I guess I would say all of the above, Your Honor, all of the above. It's a tricky thing to say to this court that maybe the court in 95 didn't quite get it right, but I think by the court's own admission, the court knew it didn't quite have the record in front of it. And for that, I would refer you to Edgewood 4, footnote 20, at page 736. And there, this court noted in this very opinion that has the very calculations, Justice Phillips, that you referred me to, the court said in footnote 20 that the district court had severed whether the legislature appropriates sufficient funds for districts to provide a constitutionally minimally accepted education, acceptable education. So the court, even though it gave those facts and figures in footnotes 10 and 12, it kind of put it out there, but then back at the other end on footnote 20 says, well, but that really wasn't before the district court. So I don't think I'm telling the court anything the court didn't quite know at the time it came up with those facts and figures. I would also refer the court to Justice Spector's dissent, because she makes the same point, which is how could you go there, how could you set the standard, but more importantly, how can you give these facts and figures when it was not part of the lawsuit? And I'll quote from her dissent. The general diffusion of knowledge requirement has never been a part of this case. The district court severed out what it called adequacy issues. Thus, there is virtually no evidence on this issue in the record. No evidence. This actually also came up in the hearing below. The judge, Justice McCown, and the litigants were all wondering, where did the court, how did it come up to have these facts and figures? And in response, here was the conversation at the trial court. Judge McCown, and this is at page 44 of the reporter's record, he says it regarding the facts and figures in footnote 10. He says, and I quote, it wasn't litigated. It wasn't before the trial court. It wasn't on appeal. Mr. Wood, for the Alvarado respondents, agreed with Justice McCown, and I quote from page 31 of the reporter's record, it wasn't even raised in the trial court, and there was no real evidence concerning some offhand comments by Commissioner Mino.
So it's still your contention here today that you ought to be, I don't know about your rendition, but at any rate, either here or down below, you ought to be able to show that, among other things, the dollar and a half cap creates an unconstitutional deprivation of
absolutely, Your Honor. I think by any measure, we should be allowed to go back to the trial court and put on our evidence and show that we are at the statutory cap and that it presents a constitutional issue under Article 8, Section 1A.
So you're not merely saying that the state needs to provide more money from other revenue sources than the local property tax?
Well, Your Honor, it's obviously going to be up to the legislature to figure out how to remedy the situation. We obviously believe additional funding from the state would be helpful, but we are not litigating the state versus local funding ratio issue that has come up in prior cases. We're merely saying that under the changed facts and circumstances that this court foresaw in Edgewood 4, that we were entitled to go forward, and then under by no circumstances should we even cut short because of some argument about the pleadings.
Ms. Cordell, I know you said you're not raising any sort of issue about the state-local funding ratio, but I did have an accounting question. As I understand the funding mechanism, the state contributes X amount of money to the school education, and they say a good chunk of that comes from the foundation school fund. And is that the money that the local districts pay into, or what contributes to that? The way they break out, that's a fund within the general revenue fund.
Right. Right.
That is supportive of the state's portion. But where does that foundation school fund come from?
That's local.
That's all local money.
Yes. I think the current breakdown roughly right now is 42% comes from the state, 58% from local. There may be a percent coming from federal.
Now, the state said, of the 40-some-odd percent that the state gives, it says, about 60% of that money, that's the state's contribution of that 40%, it says comes from the Foundation School Fund. And you're saying the Foundation School Fund is the local property tax that's paid into the state? Or, I'm just trying to figure out what it.
Do you want to answer that on rebuttal?
Can I save that one?
Sure.
Because I don't know quite how to break out. I know that I've read that they characterize the state portion as about 42% and local 50. And as the court's well aware, the history of school funding has been the state percentage has been declining markedly.
Question is a little bit more technical than that.
Okay.
The state says of its portion that it gives, the majority of that money comes from a foundation school fund that somehow is related to this foundation school program. And I'm just trying to see what is the source of the revenue that goes into the foundation school fund that then is what the state uses as its contribution. So that's just my question.
I may defer, and I know I have the benefit of a break as well, so I'll try to get you a specific answer on that.
If you have to prove the cost of the general diffusion of knowledge, I'm still not sure how you intend to do that. You're going to use a legislative standard of what that means, or you're going to make up your own, or what numbers are you going to look at? How are you going to do that?
Your Honor, I think the court has basically three options if the court's willing to go with petitioner's position. I think under any of the three options, we would prevail. I think the court can remand under what I call the Edgewood 4 standard brought current, okay? And brought current by virtue of new accreditation standards, brought current by recognition of 42.002B, and also, I believe, Edgewood 4, again, looking at the snapshot, when it said this is adequate, and by the way, I think it was meant only to be a temporary blessing for the system, but I'll let that go for a minute. But the snapshot shows there was also a little bit of margin for local enrichment. And Edgewood 4 very carefully says that in addition to the general diffusion of knowledge layer, we're also entitled to some margin for local enrichment. And I think that's what the legislature then codified in May of 95, 5 months after Edgewood 4, when it came up with 42.002B. Now, you can either talk about that margin in terms of an expanded view of general diffusion of knowledge. That would be one way to get there. Another way to get there would be to call it meaningful discretion. Because, of course, what the Edgewood 3 case tells us is that the standard is not just that you're there, but that you have meaningful discretion in your setting your taxes. So the way I look at it in terms of what the formula for a claim would be is that there are three variables. One, how many districts have to be there, which was, you know, Judge McCown's issue. Two, what is the tax rate at which you must be? And then three, how do you answer the must tax issue? And basically, if you say between $1.40 and $1.50 to allow for this meaningful discretion, to allow for enrichment, that also changes the dynamic. So you can either look at it that way, or you can look at it under an expanded view of general diffusion knowledge.
But all of this assumes you're going to come up with a number for what it costs to provide either general diffusion of knowledge, to use the language of the Constitution, or accreditation, to use the language of the legislature, which may or may not be the same. And what I'm curious about is what is your proposal for doing that? Are you going to use the legislative standards and say, well, it's the cost of educating a child on the average to pass the TOCS test, or is it something else?
Your Honor, I think the court has a variety of options to look at. Again, if you don't just stay with Edgewood 4, but want to revisit the whole issue of what are we tied to and what are the standards, there are a host of other state Supreme Courts that have looked at this precise issue about what guidance do we give the district court. And in my mind, I've grouped them into three types of cases. One, they either enunciate the factors that the lower court should look to, or they enunciate goals that the court should look to, or they talk in terms of an adequacy study. If I may.
To what extent do you think these are up to the legislature?
Well, on this issue, I think the court crossed that bridge a very long time ago. I was intrigued with Justice Enoch's observation in his dissent in Edgewood 4, where he said, you know, there is an argument that we could go back 15 years or so and say this whole issue is political and we never should have gotten involved. But the court crossed that bridge in Edgewood 1. The court has become involved, has provided guidance, and then to go through all of the Edgewood litigation and then look at Edgewood 4, Edgewood 4 gave us an engraved invitation for this very lawsuit. First of all, it did everything that we're doing, only we're just trying to update it. It went into the adequacy issue. It put numbers on it, albeit without a record, and said then that this is not a fixed standard. If there are changed legal or factual circumstances, then you can come back. Because what is supplementation today may be mandatory for a basic education tomorrow.
But surely we have to defer to them, to the second branch, to decide whether, for example, social sciences is an important part of the general curriculum.
No, I do not believe that the Texas Supreme Court should be in the business of setting out curriculum or designing achievement tests or so forth. But what this court is in the business of doing is looking at a system and saying, does it meet the constitutional requirement? Does it provide a general diffusion of knowledge? That's what this court is about. And that is exactly the mission this court has embraced, starting in 1989 and going all the way through. You know, let's go back to 1989, and let's say the legislature had said, well, we think 700-1, that meets our constitutional obligation, that's great. But that wasn't deemed satisfactory by this court, and properly so. This court embraced its obligation to measure what the legislature does against a constitutional yardstick, and that is what we're asking you to do in this case.
But this lawsuit is Article 8, Section 1E suit. It's not an Article 7, Section 1 suit, and that's mainly what you seem to be addressing there. So we were back to the paragraph about Article 8, Section 1E, that says if basically the board becomes the ceiling to meet a certain level of education, that's a statewide property. So.
No, we are a tax suit, but Your Honor, the court has embraced that, of course, twice before. In Edgewood 3, of course, the court held the system unconstitutional under that provision. And then in Edgewood 4, the issue came back up on statewide property tax, and there was a split among the court. There were three justices, of course, of this court that did find on its face that the statute, that the Senate Bill 7 is unconstitutional as a statewide property tax. And parenthetically, I know the court may not want to entertain that, but that would be a way to render on our case. I think that we...
What would be a way to render? Sorry.
I think taking the logic of the dissents in Edgewood 4, which, of course, was Your Honor and Justice Owen and Justice Enoch, and, of course, all of you found at that time that Senate Bill 7, by its structure, was an unconstitutional statewide property tax. What hadn't quite happened, the other shoe that hadn't dropped yet, was the rise of the rates to the $1.50 level. We now have that piece. This court can take judicial notice of that, and I would suggest could render on that basis.
Have we ever rendered before on dismissal for failure to
speak? I know, it's a tricky deal, Your Honor. And that's why I didn't say it first, because obviously I would, you know, if I thought that would be intuitive for the court, I would have made it my
Let
first.
Let me ask you a question.
I think a defendant would be a little surprised.
They probably are a little surprised, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear.
A little irony, he said, for the defendant to win on a failure to state a claim in the trial court and then lose on a rendition point as
yes,
a matter of law.
Yes, I understand that, Your Honor.
I have a question. I guess it is too difficult for me to be able to decide what a general diffusion of knowledge is. It seemed to me, although I wasn't with the court in Edgewood 4, they were attempting to put some sort of gloss on that by referring to accreditation. And it seems to me that the school districts need to be prepared to demonstrate that at taxing at the $1.50, they can't meet the accreditation standards set up by the legislature. I mean, there's an argument out there that the legislature can't set accreditation so low that they have people not being educated in the state. But in between that, it seems to me the burden on the district would be to establish that at $1.50, they can't meet the accreditation standards. You've referred to the TOX evaluation. You've referred to all this testing evaluation. Is it necessary for you to establish that you can't meet accreditation, that your students are failing that test, or is it necessary for you to show that you can't have classrooms with only 22 kids in them? What is it about? Do you have to show that you'll lose your accreditation with the state if you're not able to tax more? What would you have to do to show that you can't reach accreditation, I guess?
Well, that is currently being evolved by the legislature, what the passing rates need to be or not, do not need to be. Under TOS, as I understand it, it was 55%. We don't know what percent they're going to put on it. When I refer to the new regime, though, it's not only to make the point that we have a new regime, but also to make the point that the costs are going to skyrocket to prepare our students and our teachers for the new regime. Because if you have to prepare everybody for a lesser test, it's just not as expensive as now they're going to be tested in biology, integrated physics, chemistry, so forth, subjects they've never been tested on before, curriculum that's never been required before. So whatever the cost picture looks like right this second, if anyone looks into even this next fall, the measures
but if you're
up.
Not, if, but I mean, how does the court, if you're not threatened with decertification by the state, how does the court measure whether or not you can reach accreditation? If you say you get decertified if you get 50% of your students failing the test, I guess that's a pretty bright line thing you can look at. But if only 40% fail this test, do you meet the constitutional standard that taxing $1.50 you can't meet the credit?
Well, we would say no. I mean, but let me make a first comment. Even if you maintain the standards of Edgewood 4, even if you just say accreditation, I still believe we absolutely have stated a claim and are entitled to make our case in the trial court. That's number one.
Would your claim be that one of your districts is taxing at the rate to meet that standard that was $1.22 and $1.31 back in 1995, that you need to show that one plaintiff's district no longer has any discretion, that a substantial number, Court of Appeals seemed to think one was enough. District court seemed to think it was 50% of the districts, never mind how many students. Obviously, for the district court, those 50% wouldn't all have to be plaintiffs in the case. The Court of Appeals seemed to act like it didn't matter how many other districts over here were up against the cap. If none of them were plaintiffs in the case, it was irrelevant. Can you speak some to both what the standard has to be and how interested that district has to be? Do they have to be in the litigation?
Your Honor, I guess, again, all of the above, because I think we can meet all of the above. If it is one student, I think that's supportable because of the exact wording of Article 8, Section 1A. It says if there can be no statewide property tax on any property. I'm sorry?
State, not statewide.
I'm sorry. That's an important point. Thank you for pointing that out, Your Honor.
So you think one district would be enough. Now, does that district have to be a plaintiff in the case? Or can you come in and say, we found a district 800 miles away that meets this standard?
Your Honor, I believe that we can meet the standard with the present plaintiffs. I think there was an intention to have this case come forward.
Well, if the trial court finds you can, but finds that some other district has, is that enough to
We believe it is, Your Honor. And we also believe that even if we were back in front of Judge McCown today, that we would be allowed to go forward. And that is indeed the irony. Because with the passage of time,
why don't you just dismiss this suit and start over?
That's a good question, Your Honor, and I guess one could always do that. But let me explain something to you that we think is very important, and I'm glad you asked the question. We would not like a pure remand. In our best of all worlds, we would like this court to clarify what the standards are, because there does indeed seem to be some confusion. We believe that
there's no point in telling you to replead if we don't tell you what to replead.
Exactly so, and to give guidelines to the court. The point we want to make here.
That's not the same thing as revisiting the standard in Edgewood 4. You talked about revisiting the ruling, the constitutional holding in Edgewood 4. This case is for us essentially on a pleading issue, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
I agree we certainly have to provide guidance, or should provide guidance, if we remand. Are you saying we necessarily have to revisit Edgewood 4, or is that on your wish list?
It's on my wish list, but it's not a necessary. We believe that you can decide the case within the confines of Edgewood 4, and we're still entitled to go back down and have our case. We believe, alternatively, the court can revisit what the standards are. I think, as I said earlier, a lot of courts have struggled with how to do it, but they've still gone there and done it. And if I may cite the court to one authority, and it's 78 North Carolina Law Review, page 399, and that's notes 86 and 87. It gives you a listing of not all, but a good number of the cases where the courts have, in fact, struggled with this issue of how to create the standards and how they should read. One of the main cases in this area is the Rose case that Justice Cornyn did cite in his concurring opinion in Edgewood 3. Anyway, I'm just saying, so one, yes, under Edgewood 4, we get a remand, but we would still like clarification. Number two, you can allow us to revisit the accreditation link, and on that I make the point that I hope you'll investigate on respondents, which is that the interveners all agree that the accreditation standard is too low and that general diffusion of knowledge is justiciable, and you should not tie it to accreditation. So I invite you to talk with them about that.
Let me ask you real quickly. If we remand and you want guidance from us, what would you like that guidance to be? That you'd have to replead to show what?
Your Honor, I'm just going to give you the shorthand. That's why I gave you the large article on the cases, and I realize it's not fleshed out as much.
I guess what I'm saying, what is your pleading going to look like on remand? What do you want our standard
to be? Our idea would be that you have either one or some districts that plead that they have to tax between $1.40 and $1.50, because that's our meaningful discretion.
To do what?
To do
and
what?
And that's the part that we're struggling with.
In order to provide a general diffusion of knowledge as defined by, and I could go with any of these, the goals and standards approach of Rose, of the Rose case, which I can cite to you, or I can give you, I could read that to you.
But you would separate it from the accreditation standard. You don't want that to be the mandate on remand, that it has to be basic accreditation.
Well, again, our position is either. Our preferred, we think, for the school children of Texas, we think it best not to tie them down to accreditation standards. That is simply too low. As this court observed in Edgewood 4, this state can do better. It can do better.
The remark you just made about pleadings, though, isn't that exactly what the commissioner was begging you to do back down in the district court, to plead that precisely, that what you were claiming was the $1.50 was inadequate to provide a general diffusion of knowledge? I thought that's what their argument was.
Well, and we did plead that, Your Honor. I think by any measure our pleading ties to general diffusion of knowledge. What the Court of Appeals picked up on is not just general diffusion of knowledge, but that you also have to tie to accreditation standards. So what we did plead that. And what you ought to look at in the Alvarado special exception is they did not say that petitioners must plead that they are at $1.50 to accomplish accreditation, because they don't want that to be the standard. The four districts do not want that to be the standard any more than we don't want that to be the standard. This is an issue that cuts across all wealth levels in this state. That is too low a standard.
Talk about, real quick, the optional homestead. Are any of the plaintiffs, do they all grant, all four districts, do they grant this optional homestead?
They do, Your Honor, but of course that is provided for in the legislation.
If this court holds that can't do that and be making a maximum effort, $1.50, do you lose your case?
We do not believe so, Your Honor, because what you're talking about is a very little amount of money. It really doesn't change the overall analysis at all. Three-quarters of our plaintiffs have mostly commercial properties, so the amount of money you would gain by taxing the 20% of homestead is very negligible. And in any event,
That argument that it won't be that hard to go ahead and take that back?
I'm sorry?
I said, can't the districts go ahead and rescind that if it's not going to be that much money?
Well, they could, but there are a lot of political problems with taking away Homestead, of course, and to not recognize that and to say that we have meaningful discretion because we can gain a few more dollars by depriving homeowners of a little added protection that both the Texas Constitution and the legislation contemplates that we can give them. I just don't think that that runs afoul of the meaningful discretion standard of Edgewood 3 at all.
Ms. Cartel, during your break, I'd like to get that law review article that you cited.
Yes, Your Honor.
Carolina, I believe. I didn't hear all of
it. You want to go ahead and just state it right
now? Yeah.
It's at 78 North Carolina Law Review, page 399. In particular, I refer the court to footnotes 86 and 87, which provides the court a shorthand survey of other Texas Supreme Courts who have decided that they must address these very issues and have provided mechanisms for doing so. There are also some specific cases I would refer the court to. One is Rose, the Rose case that was cited by Justice Cornyn in Edgewood 3 on a kind of a goals-type analysis that the court could go off on. I'd refer you to the Leandro case, 488 Southeast 2nd, 249. And if the court wanted to go an adequacy study route, that's the Wyoming Supreme Court, 907 Pacific 2nd, 1238. And I will, on rebuttal, give some examples of how these courts, how they spell it out for the lower court when they send it back down, the kind of guidelines that they give.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That concludes petitioner's opening argument. The court will now take a brief recess.
All right.
May it please the court, has been the case in this case since the very first hearing in the trial court. The petitioners raise many issues and many arguments, all of which are very interesting, but have nothing to do with the case that they tried to plead in their petition. This is a tax case under Article 8, Section 1E, in which they seek to say that their ad valorem taxes have in effect de facto become a state-imposed ad valorem tax because they have lost all meaningful discretion in setting those rates.
Let me ask you, it seems to me that things have changed since the Court of Appeals opinion and today. The impression I got from the Court of Appeals opinion was that they could not plead that they could meet, that they had a tax at $1.50 to meet the basic accreditation standard. Today they say they can. So why should they not be allowed then to go replead that if they can? Because I thought it was your position that's what they had to be able to do.
If they will plead that they must tax at $1.50, at the rate of $1.50, without providing a homestead exemption, and that they must do so in order to provide an accredited education or whatever it is that they are compelled to do under the system, which is currently to provide an accredited education, We'll conduct discovery and go forward in the case.
The state's argument seems a little cynical when it says you have to not count the homestead exemption when you know as a practical matter they can't do that.
Yes, they can. Under the Constitution, it is an optional homestead exemption.
As a practical matter, they can't do it.
Well, the practical pressure upon them is a political pressure, which is in and of itself the very exercise of meaningful discretion.
Oh, I understand, but what you're arguing is, if they'll just commit political suicide, they can win this case, and they don't want to do that.
If the people of their district, and this gets us back to, this is an ad valorem tax case. It is a state tax case. Under the standard of Edgewood 4, and we go back to Edgewood 3, we know that the state cannot directly say, you must tax at this rate, and you must do this with your money you raise. We know they can't do that. That violates Article 8, Section 1E. What Edgewood 3 said and Edgewood 4 said is, nor can you so control their discretion that they in effect lose all meaningful discretion. As long as they are forced and compelled to tax at $1.50 so that the cap becomes both the floor and the ceiling, then you've got what Edgewood 4 recognized to be an indirect state ad valorem tax.
Forgetting homestead, why can't they think that?
I encourage, and perhaps I heard it differently than the court did, I encourage this court to request counsel to say that they, in good faith under Rule 13, can go to the trial court and plead that their plaintiff districts must be at $1.50 without a homestead exemption in order to provide an accredited education.
What if they can prove that some other district in the state, not currently a plaintiff, is at that, right, so that there are students who are part of a district that has no discretion?
Two answers to that question. First is they have no standing to assert that if they're asserting it simply on behalf of some district that's not a party in the case. Second is they, in order to show this type of indirect, de facto state ad valorem tax, they've got to show that all districts, as a result of the way that the system works throughout the state, must be at the $1.50 cap.
Everyone,
and of course we argued that in the trial court, and the trial court disagreed with the state on that point and said no, but at least a constitutionally significant number must be, because what you've got to show is that the system as it is set up has the effect of, not that it directly does, but that it has the effect of causing all districts to lose meaningful discretion.
Well, it's a state.
When we said some in Edgewood 4, we meant most or all?
No, when Edgewood 4 said some, it was a recognition of the reality that some districts may end up having to tax at that rate. But the very next sentence is what lays the standard for this case, which is if it gets to the point where the districts must be, and it's plural, districts must be at that cap, so that the cap has become a floor and a ceiling, then it would be a conclusion that it has become a statewide, and the court used the phrase statewide, implying that the court recognized that we were talking not simply about a direct state tax, but a tax that has a statewide implication.
Let's assume that it's a pretty easy, threshold for a plaintiff who is thrown out on a failure to state a claim to get the opportunity to replead. So let's assume the court says go back and you get an opportunity to replead on this issue. What is the state's position about what it is they have to show? They reach the $1.50, they have to tax at $1.50 in order to meet that accreditation. I don't know how else you'd establish general diffusion, but would they have to show that 50% of their students fail the TOX test, or do they just have to show that they're unable to put only 22 students in a class with a teacher? What do you say would be the demonstration that they couldn't meet the accreditation standards?
Well, it would be a factual determination as to whether or not they could meet. We're dealing here with a pleading standard. They've refused to even plead that. But if they were to plead that, we'd get into the factual determination of whether, in fact, at the rate of $1.45 or $1.48, they can raise enough funds to meet the accreditation standards. The court has to understand, as the Edgewood 4 court
did. But I was just asking I don't know. It seemed to me, what are the accreditation standards? I mean, they could sit there and say, well, we can't raise enough money to accreditation standards. I want to know what about the accreditation standards they can't meet. So that was my question to you.
And that's what we would ask them through discovery. What is it that is required under the accountability regime of Chapter 39 of the Education Code that you cannot do unless your rates are greater than $1.50? That's what we would ask them to show. We're not asking them to plead all those exact facts in their petition. We're simply saying, to state a claim to even get to the discovery phase, you've got to show that you've lost all meaningful discretion.
Didn't they also ask for discovery on the cost to meet an accredited education? Wasn't that part?
There was no discovery conducted in the trial.
Weren't they asking for that? They said we aren't required to accept the state's numbers. And why should they be required to accept at face value the state's numbers on what it costs to provide an accreditation?
They did want to have an opportunity to conduct discovery in that, but that request was made in the context of the argument that they briefed before this court, which is we should have a right to try and prove that the accreditation standards are not sufficient to meet the constitutional requirement of the general.
And we left that out on the Edgewood 4 very explicitly. Why aren't they entitled to complete that and go do some discovery?
And this is the key question in this case. This. They can't, the issue that